The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hi, it's Brendan here. Before we get into this week's episode, I just wanted to let you know about our next online event. On Wednesday, the 26th of June at 8 p.m, I'll be sitting down with Melanie Phillips, the brilliant broadcaster and Times columnist. Melanie and I will be live and in conversation via Zoom talking about why Israel must win the war against Hamas, the grim rise of anti-Semitism, and the crisis of the West. We'll also be taking questions from you, the audience. This is a free event exclusive to Spiked supporters, our online donor community. If you're already a Spiked supporter, you can sign up for your ticket now on our online donor hub. And if you're not already a Spiked supporter, now is the perfect time to become one. For as little as £5 a month, you can get your ticket to this event. Plus, you'll enjoy loads of other exclusive perks like ad-free reading, access to our comments section, and access to many more live events like this one. To become a Spiked supporter, go to spiked-online.com/supporters. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. And I'll see you there on Wednesday, the 26th of June at 8 p.m.
In the long run, those who are most interested in advancing the well-being of African-American, struggling, poor, and disadvantaged populations do best by fashioning their politics in such a manner that they can coalesce with the interests of other working peoples, not basing it on racial claims, basing it on we should have a better society, we should have policies that promote advancement of those who are trying to improve their lives. That's something that is universal, that transcends the identitarian boundary, and that's the way we should be looking at the world.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Glenn Lowry. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brendan. Good to be with you.
It's always good to have you on. And I really want to talk to you about your new book, which is called Late Admissions, Confessions of a Black Conservative. I've got so many questions I want to ask you about this book, especially about the political journey that you've been on and the ups and downs that you've been through. But I have to start off by asking you, what compelled you to write this book? Now, you're a famed economist, you're a celebrated economist, you've written many books, you've taught at Harvard, you teach at Brown, but this is not a normal economist's memoir. I mean, I've not seen an economist memoir before where the writer talks about smoking crack on an aeroplane and picking up prostitutes and having an affair with his best friend's wife and all the other very interesting life stories you tell in this memoir. So it is a very distinctive economist's memoir. And I just wanted to ask you, what compelled you to write it and what compelled you to put so much personal stuff in there? You've really laid your life out for people.
I don't know that there is a straightforward answer to that question. It's perhaps something we would come to know only after psychoanalysis at length. I've lived a colorful life and much of it has been in public. And I felt the need to give an account of myself to the public, yes, to intimate associates of mine, including my children and family, and maybe at some level to myself. Maybe I needed to review the record and ask myself, how did I come to be in the situations that I found myself in, and what was really going on with me in some of the darker moments, some of the more challenging moments in my life, to, as it were, come clean. And as I took up this project, I distinguished between a kind of self-presentation management where I would carefully edit what it is I told the public in the interest of making myself look this way or that, and more of a commitment to, if you will, the truth of the life as best I could discern it, without regard or without careful and manicured attention to the image that would be left, thinking that if the man bears his soul honestly and candidly, if he plumbs deeply into the root of things and exhibits that honestly, that the reader will come to appreciate the man for his candor, for his quest for truth, for his humanity. And that would be my image management. My image management would be, here I am, warts and all, struggling to come to terms with the life. You can see me on the page, come to the conclusions that you will, but I'm not pulling your leg. I'm not trying to manipulate you or gaslight you. I'm trying to tell you the way it really was.
Yeah, that's very well put. And I think it was the New York Times review that said, your memoir passes the Orwell test, because George Orwell said, if you read a memoir by a great man and it's all nice and happy and positive, then they're probably not telling the truth. And yours certainly isn't always that. But I wanted to ask you what you've thought about some of the response to the memoir. In some of the reviews, it's quite interesting that they come to the conclusion that you're a very interesting person, but not necessarily a nice person, or that you haven't always been a nice person. And that I think one of the reviews said that halfway through the book, they found that they were disliking you more and more, even as they were drawn along by your personal journey and your political journey. And you're referred to by some as a kind of Jekyll and Hyde character that comes through in the memoir. Were you prepared for those kinds of reactions? What have you thought about some of the reaction to the memoir?
Yeah, prepared. I don't know if I can say I was prepared. I was on guard. A dear friend of mine whom I showed the book to in draft, someone I've known for 50 years, said to me, you know, I'm not sure I like that guy that I discovered in this book. To which I responded, I don't know that I like him either. I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy. And in fact, that guy could never have faced up to the truth of his life in a way that allowed him to write this book. The guy that wrote the book is the guy that you're talking to. Hopefully, you'll give me some credit for at least being honest about that guy.
Absolutely. Okay, well, you'll be pleased to hear, I think, that I'm not a psychoanalyst, so I'm not going to do that element of analyzing why you wrote the book and why you thought it was important to do so. But I am very interested in your political journey. I have been for a long time, in fact, even before I read this memoir. And there are some things I wanted to ask you, because you've been all around, politically speaking. You've been more on the left, you've been more on the right, you've been cast out from both tribes at different times for displeasing them with your views. So I wanted to ask you about that journey in a bit more depth. And one of the things that struck me in the book is that one of the first times, I think, that you discovered your more conservative leanings was during the Vietnam War, when you found that you just couldn't make a connection with the draft dodgers. You couldn't make a connection with the kids who were burning their drafts in the streets and saying, hell no, we won't go. And you felt more affinity with blue collar workers, some of whom you were associating with at the time, who didn't have time to protest, didn't have time to go on the streets all day long. How formative was that moment for you, that Vietnam moment? It must have felt quite isolating for a young person at the time to find yourself on the side that you found yourself on.
Well, it was very important. I should explain that I'm from a working class background, Chicago, and I was a college dropout and a very young father. I became a father at the age of 18, dropped out of school and went to work in a factory, a printing plant, which was full of working class skilled and laboring tradesmen and craftsmen and women, but mostly men. They were largely ethnic Chicago, Irish, Jewish, Italian, Polish, Greek. They were blue-collar workers. They weren't radicals. I identified with those men, notwithstanding the fact that I'm Black and they were one variety or other of so-called white. There was a class bond. I had a family. I had children to feed. I was hoping to get overtime, working the second shift 4 p.m. to midnight and hoping to get another 4 hours tacked on to that so I could put some bread on the table. It was that kind of a world that I found myself in 1967, 68, 69, 1970, as I was taking classes first at night and then during the day, working 40 hours a week and overtime if I could get it, tending to my wife and children, as well as my studies. And I thought of the protesting radical Students for a Democratic Society, hippie, pot smoking kids. They weren't my people. And this was the crucible out of which some of my political heterodoxy developed, I think.
Yeah, listening to you talk there, and of course reading the book too, it does bring to mind the hard hat protests of 1970, which is when a group of blue-collar workers, construction workers, I think, in this instance, and other workers as well, pushed back against a bunch of anti-Vietnam War protesters who were protesting against the shootings at Kent State University and also against Nixon's decision to bomb Cambodia. It was such an interesting moment that you had those blue collar workers who in New York City who were standing up to the hippies, as you just described them there. Thinking about that and also reading your memoir, it did make me wonder if back then, in that attitude you described where you felt you couldn't connect with the draft dodgers or the hippie element, if you think there was an element back then of the kind of almost like a prototype to the Trump movement of recent years, where you have a more blue-collar element of society who have been quiet or silent for a long time, but every now and then they kind of blow up and say, look, we think this politics is crazy, we think we should do something different. Is that how you see those kind of hard hat protests and the sentiment that you encountered amongst blue-collar workers where they weren't interested in that more radical politics?
I suppose you could make the connection. It's a long time. I think the things that drive the less well-educated and more working-class elements today in American politics to support Trump to the extent that they do are quite different from what was going on in the 1960s and early 1970s. I want to be clear, it's not as if I were a proponent of the war in Southeast Asia back in those years. It's just that I didn't identify with the radical youth who were rebelling against the establishment in the face of that war. Those were not my people. But I think the theme that progressive politics in the sway of the intellectuals and those who hate capitalism, those who don't like the nuclear family, who embrace every avant-garde cultural deviation that comes along, who have contempt for ordinary people's daily lives, that's a theme that I think is applicable in many circumstances, applicable in the case of the anti-Vietnam War protest, and also applicable in the present day with respect to the wide support that Trump enjoys in certain quarters.
Yeah, by the way, I'm with you on the wars in Southeast Asia. I'm too young to have been around then, but I would have been against those two in both Vietnam and Cambodia. I want to move on to when you started going to Northwestern and you start attending university and you start getting involved not only in academic studies, but also, I guess, in discussion and political debate. And one striking part of the book is that that's a time at which you started to bristle, not necessarily at Black activism, but certainly at wealthier Black students who were mimicking radicalism or presenting themselves as these kind of people who'd soared up through the struggle and got to university and were now going to stomp their radical presence in the world. And you bristled at those kinds of people too. Could you just explain a little bit about what you thought about so-called Black politics when you were in university, what that meant to you and why you had a problem with some of it?
Well, let me explain that I was at a community college and I transferred to the university, Northwestern University, in my junior year, my third year of college. I was at Northwestern for 2 years in the summer in between. And it was moving between worlds. At the community college, it was working class and lower class, people who couldn't pay big tuitions for at fancy universities and who were trying to better their lives. I was one of them. People of various ethnic and racial backgrounds. It was an integrated, racially integrated, but largely working class environment that I found myself in community college. And when I arrived at Northwestern University, I was introduced to an entirely new world, an elite, leafy green, lakefront, wealthy campus populated largely by wealthy and upper middle class, well-heeled students. And that was true of the Black students there, as well as of the white students. And I had troubles connecting and relating to those students. And some of this, I think, has to be chalked up to the fact that I had a huge chip on my shoulder. I was getting off work at 7 a.m. some mornings and driving an hour through Chicago up to the northern suburb of Evanston, Illinois, to attend my 9 a.m. class. And these kids were rolling out of bed, you know, they'd been up partying all night the night before, so I envisioned. They were going to spend their weekend at the beach with the top down on their nice convertibles, and they were more interested in what kind of clothes they were wearing and what parties they were going to go to, so I imagined. And I resented them. I called them the Negro cognoscenti, and their politics I took to be not rooted, not grounded in actual experience. I was from a working class neighborhood. I knew people who were in prison or who were engaged in various kinds of marginal activities in order to get by. I knew housing projects. Some of my family, my mother's brother and children and so on, grew up in housing projects, and I spent a fair amount of time in those places. There was a sense in which I saw myself as more authentic, authentically African-American, working class, struggling to try to make it in America. And I saw these youngsters, again, it may be unfair to them, but such was my posture at that time, as privileged and as able to indulge their various political enthusiasms without having to actually root it in the experience of struggling people. Even as I recall it now, though, I chastise myself a little bit because I think I really did have this attitude. I walked around with a briefcase with bumper stickers slapped on either side that said, "Rise above it," because that was my attitude. My attitude was I was going to rise above the disadvantaged circumstances of my origin, and I was going to make something out of this world. And I was working a full-time job, taking a full-time curriculum and caring for children and trying to develop my relationship with my wife and maintaining a household and so on. I was pulling my weight and more. And I thought of many of my compatriots and co-racialists in that elite college campus environment as not knowing anything about the realities of life such as I did.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
I did actually want to ask you about that phrase, Negro cognoscenti, because it is a very striking phrase that I've seen you use in the book, and you've used it before as well. There's a great section in the book where you say, "This brother wouldn't know struggle if it pinned him down and sat on his head." And you're referring there to the black kids at university who you encountered. As you say now, it's possible you were being a bit hard on them. You do describe how you had a chip on your shoulder. You were working hard in a job as well as attending university. Leaving that possibility to one side, that you were being slightly harsh on these performatively radical black kids, do you think that experience at university was an early example of the tensions possibly between class politics and, I guess, an early version of identity politics? So between people in the broadest sweep of America who were trying to make ends meet and had an interest in economic improvement, and then this newer layer of society that was more interested, I guess, in identity questions, cultural questions, and who would then eventually go on to be quite dominant in left-wing circles. Looking back, do you see that kind of tension there in those experiences you had at Northwestern?
I do, Brendan. I think you put it very well. I wish I had said it in that way myself. Precisely so. Class politics versus identity politics at a critical moment, late 1960s, early 1970s, identity politics is being born, and the prerogatives of these, who I'm calling the Negro cognoscenti, are largely rooted in their status as members of an oppressed class, that is, an oppressed identity, African Americans, the descendants of slaves. But it's not cognizant of their class location. Like I said, I was working in this factory, and I felt a lot in common with the people whom I was encountering there. And they identified with me, not because I was a member of some identity group, but because I was trying to better my life, coming, as it were, from nothing or not very much, working my tail off, getting dirt under my fingernails, showing up, punching a clock, hoping for overtime, and scraping nickels together to try to make a life, and going to school. The foreman on the shop floor, the noisy shop floor with the machines and the trucks and the huge rolls of paper going into these presses and the barrels of ink and all that. He opened his door of his office at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was working the midnight shift, urging me to go in there where it would be quiet so I could type up the draft of my paper for my literature class that was going to be due in a couple of days, because he identified with my struggle to better my life. He was of Polish ancestry, so what? Identity politics versus class politics, and the sensibility which I have maintained over these years that in the long run, those who are most interested in advancing the well-being of African-American, struggling, poor, and disadvantaged populations do best by fashioning their politics in such a manner that they can coalesce with and align with the interests of other working peoples, not basing it on racial claims, but basing it on we should have a better society, a decent society. We should have policies that promote the development and advancement of those who are trying to improve their lives, who are struggling against the odds. And that's something that is universal, that transcends the identitarian boundary. And that's the way we should be looking at the world.
I couldn't agree more. And your book, just so listeners know, is full of these fascinating stories about your experiences working, going to university, the different people you encountered. So everyone should read that to get a greater sense of the kind of situations you're describing there. But I think what you've just outlined there sums up very well the tragedy of identity politics, because class politics, for all its various faults and the fact that it can sometimes go down strange avenues, at least had that universalizing experience where people felt bonded not by their racial characteristics or their national heritage or their religious motivations or whatever else it might be, but by the fact they had a shared economic interest, a shared interest in self-improvement in the workplace, improvement in the community. And I think that really comes through well in the way you describe some of your first workplaces. Do you think the way in which identity politics is now seen as left-wing politics, even though I don't consider it particularly left-wing, at least not in the traditional sense. Do you think that kind of spells the death knell of what a more genuinely left politics traditionally would have represented?
Well, I have to confess here that I'm not a man of the left and haven't invested a lot of my intellectual energies in trying to figure out, well, what went wrong? Why is the left not more effective than it would be? But as an observer of American political life, I think that that's definitely the case. I think the extent to which the left and self-consciously progressive forces in American politics have allowed themselves to be mired in the narratives and the rhetoric and the demands of the identitarians has worked to their detriment. And I think the rise of Donald J. Trump as a phenomenon in American politics is evidence precisely of that fact.
I want to ask you about a bit later now in your life, your political journey, when you start writing for magazines. So we're going, I guess, to the 1980s, the 1990s, the 2000s. What's really interesting about your book, I think I knew this, but it was useful to be reminded of it, is the extent to which your political experiences really foretold a lot of what's going on now in terms of the culture wars and the difficulty to talk about the issues facing America without being accused of racism. Your experiences really kind of gave a hint of what's to come, I think. And I did want to ask you about when you first started writing about some of the problems facing African-American communities in the United States. And one of the issues that you really started to talk about and write about was the problem of violent crime, and where more radical voices or more left-wing voices at that time, and still now, in fact, were saying the problem is the police, the racist police and everything that they're doing. You were talking about the threat posed by mugging and murderers, and the fact that there are fairly significant sections of the African-American community in the United States who still live in neighborhoods that are beset by crime, where walking down the street can be a risky business, not necessarily because there's a white cop with a gun, but because there might be someone who wants to steal your money or violate you or whatever else it might be. Why did you think it was important at that time to speak up about those things? And can you give us a sense of what kind of reaction you had from other voices in the African-American writing community at that time?
Yes, I can remember very clearly when this sensibility emerged in my own thinking, this sensibility of realizing that the way in which the activists, civil rights organizations, leaders, and spokespersons were reacting to the urban crisis and the reality on the ground of those who had to live in these disadvantaged urban communities were in conflict. I moved to the University of Michigan as a professor in 1979, which is located in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is just 35 miles to the west of the city of Detroit. So I spent time in the city of Detroit, and I was a close observer of the social, political, economic life of that city, being nearly a resident. There was a Democratic congressman representing part of the city named John Conyers. He's no longer living, but he served for decades in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was early in his career at that time and a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and was able to convene hearings on relevant issues affecting his constituents in the House of Representatives of the U.S. government. And he was spending his time holding hearings on police brutality. And I was picking up the newspaper and reading about a outbreak of rapes of teenage girls walking to school through their neighborhoods in the city of Detroit. And I wanted to know, where was the fury, the outrage that would be directed against those who were perpetrating these crimes of predation in our community? And it was nowhere to be found in the rhetoric and the actions of the political representative of the community. And I thought that was anomalous at best, that when I picked up the documents describing what the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, a leading civil rights organization, or what the National Urban League or the Civil Rights Coalition leadership were pronouncing as major issues, had nothing to say about criminal victimization of their constituents in these communities. I thought that anomalous. It was my assessment then, and frankly, it remains my assessment now, that the issues of police misbehavior, which are real and warrant to be dealt with, are minuscule in comparison to the issues of violent predatory behavior within these communities. And I thought the cast of mind that would minimize that violent predatory behavior, that would ignore it or excuse it or say, there's nothing to be done about it until we have the revolution, until socialism comes, and until there is equal opportunity in all communities, that would not hold the perpetrators of these predatory acts responsible for what they do, that would not convey to the public that the responsible leadership of our community have values that prioritize public safety and that condemn the criminal behavior of those who make life impossible for their fellow residents, that kind of philosophy would not find a voice in the speeches and in the literature of the major civil rights organization. This troubled me. And that disquiet created by what I thought was this failure of leadership led me to speak out. I began to do so in magazine articles that were published from the early 1980s onward.
Yeah. And I think when I was reading your book on this question, and obviously listening to your podcast where you discuss these issues quite regularly, I was thinking to myself that you and a few others did quite gallantly try to push a different view of some of the problems afflicting African American communities, acknowledging that the police can indeed be a problem and that they do behave badly towards African American people in the United States, but that there are other more significant problems that need to be addressed. As I was reading that and thinking about that, I was thinking that for all your brave efforts on that front, it does seem as though the kind of problem you're describing of a kind of blindness to those issues has got worse, if anything. So if we think about the defund the police slogan, the defund the police movement, some of the arguments that were put forward by Black Lives Matter after 2020 in particular, some of the fallout from the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, it does seem as though your argument that people in African American communities deserve protection from the predation that exists in their communities as it exists in others, that's kind of almost like a lost argument. And instead, the focus is now still, if anything, more than ever, on the problem of the police, and even on the issue of removing the police from certain areas, rather than expecting them to protect African American citizens from the threats that they face.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that was very well said. I mean, there are roughly 10,000 homicides with Black victims in this country. 95% of those are perpetrated by African-American offenders. And there are a few dozen cases where a Black suspect has been killed by police under circumstances in which the police could plausibly be held to be in violation of their appropriate rules of conduct. The relative magnitudes of those two problems couldn't be further apart, and yet you would think that it was the latter and not the former that constituted the major threat to the well-being of Black people in the United States. That's ideologically convenient for people who want to get on a bandwagon and inveigh against policing as such. But the withdrawal of policing from low-income, segregated, concentrated poverty, urban communities would be a betrayal of the entitlement of the residents of those communities to what most of us take for granted, which is we can go to bed at night without hearing gunshots. We don't have to worry about sending our children out to play at 6 o'clock in the evening or having them walk to school in the morning. We don't worry that there are strangers lurking in the back of our house who might be coming in to assault us or to rob our home when we're not around. And so security, we take for granted the basics of security, which is the first business of the state to provide. And yet we have radical activists who are asking for withdrawing of the state resources that are necessary to achieve security in the lowest income neighborhoods. And I think it's anomalous. And I agree with your assessment that the posture of activist leadership advocating the well-being of low-income African Americans is not sensitive to, or in fact is hostile to this very point that I'm making.
Yeah. I think the contemporary left or the identitarian left, however we want to refer to them, I think their inability to appreciate how important cultural security is to working class communities, I think that is their gravest error. And unquestionably, one of the reasons that lots of people in those parts of the world might be moving towards Donald Trump or other forms of populism as we have in Europe, because the neglect of their right to community safety and community security by sections of the cultural elite, I think, is unforgivable, and no doubt having a big impact on how those people view political life more broadly. I did want to ask you about another journey that you've been on, or another issue that you raised very early in your career, and your book recounts this as well, which is your criticisms of affirmative action. And I think your argument is essentially that, you know, affirmative action had a role to play in the civil rights era when African Americans were finally entering public life to a certain extent in a way that they ought to have been doing much earlier. But then you argue that affirmative action outstayed its welcome, and it became a problem because it risked disincentivizing African-American kids from really persevering with their studies in order to be the best they could and to get into university on merit rather than as a consequence of some policy enforced by the government. I just wanted to ask you where you stand on affirmative action now, whether you feel hopeful at some of the discussions that we've seen around affirmative action over the past couple of years, where some universities have even started to interrogate their affirmative action policies to a certain extent, particularly vis-a-vis the impact that they have on Asian students who feel incredibly aggrieved by affirmative action and feel that they're not being treated fairly. Do you feel on that issue people like you have won, or do you think there's still a lot more work to do?
I think we're winning. I think the Supreme Court's decision last year in those Harvard University and University of North Carolina cases, where the court held a 6-3 majority that the use of affirmative action, racially based affirmative action, was inconsistent with the 14th Amendment to Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution, is a harbinger of a sea change that is unfolding before our very eyes, in which I think we're going to be moving further and further away from explicit racial preference in public programs that are aimed at redressing inequality problems. And I think that in the year 2024, one quarter of the way through the 21st century, a lifetime since the height of the civil rights movement and the advent of affirmative action, in a country which is not and hasn't been for some time only Black and white, but that is a multi-ethnic, multiracial democracy that is vital and dynamic and changing, where scores of millions of immigrants from non-European ports of call have arrived and made their lives here. So I was heartened to see the court interpret the Constitution in that way. And I do think it's a harbinger of a much broader revision in the way that we think about these policies. Now, I have to acknowledge, coming along in Chicago, a working class kid, a college dropout who ended up with a fancy degree from an elite campus, even though I had a checkered record before I enrolled there. I had, you know, not exactly distinguished myself in my previous college career, and yet I was admitted with a full scholarship at Northwestern University in 1970 as an undergraduate transfer student, and I flourished there. I think you could call that affirmative action. I think Northwestern University was interested in attracting some students from my neighborhood and my social location to join them in 1970, and I benefited from that. When I got to MIT, where I did my PhD, and I came in with a very strong record as an undergraduate from Northwestern, I'd like to think that I would have been admitted to MIT regardless of my racial identity. But the fact is that in the year 1972, when I enrolled as a first-year PhD student at MIT, the department there had a policy of admitting three African-American students in each year, and they did so in each year from 1970 to 1976 or 78, if I'm not mistaken, as a part of this program, because they wanted to contribute to diversifying the cadres of academic economists. They wanted to train some Black students, and they knew that they wouldn't, without special efforts, be able to do so. And so they had this program. I was admitted. I was one of the three in the year that I came in. again, I say I'd like to think I would have been admitted regardless, but I don't know that, and I could not know that. So I benefited from affirmative action. And I would say, as a historical observation, that in 1970, where you're right on the tail end of the civil rights movement, you're just beginning to open up American institutions to equal opportunity for participation by Black students. You have a political upheaval going on in the country at large around these issues. There's a sense of wanting to repair the consequences of historical unfairness to African Americans. And there is a vast underrepresentation of people from that community in the various elite venues, that a very plausible case for some extraordinary efforts to redress the historical inheritance could be made. But that was 1970. We're way down the line from 1970, and the question arises as to whether this is the way the country, the United States of America, wants to carry on its affairs in perpetuity. In 2003, I think it was, when the late Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, in an opinion about another affirmative action case, said, I should hope the activities that we approve here, they upheld affirmative action, will not be necessary in 25 years. I think she was exactly right to indicate, as Justice Roberts, in his opinion in the most recent affirmative action case, reiterated, this thing has to have a date of termination. This is not something that we can just do as a way of life in this country and think that we're being consistent with our founding principles. And I associate myself with that position. And I think the issue of the Asians makes this point vividly. There weren't very many Asian-descended students applying to American universities in 1970. There are a lot of them applying to American universities in the year 2024. The country has changed. It's a dynamic, ongoing enterprise that we have here. The way that we fashion our policy and our law has to respect the rights of these people. The evidence that they were being discriminated against in admissions that was presented at trial and in the appellate process in the recent affirmative action case is overwhelming. These Asian kids applying to get admitted to Harvard University face a much lower chance of successful application conditional on their qualifications than those who were not. That's not the way that we want to conduct our affairs in this country, it seems to me. Now, you also mentioned my observation that the incentives built into affirmative action can work against the interests of African Americans, because you're telling kids they don't have to be as good as they otherwise might have to be in order to enjoy the benefits from their application to this or that educational program. Why would we tell kids whose performance we want to enhance that they can enjoy the fruits of successful matriculation without performing at the very highest level? That's the wrong signal to send to them, I would maintain. But more than that, it also devalues the achievement, and it robs them of an opportunity to enjoy the honor associated with success, because as Justice Clarence Thomas has said on many occasions, it puts an asterisk next to their achievement, which we politely agree not to notice, we agree not to discuss or to talk about it, but which is there nonetheless. So I don't think it's any solution, affirmative action. It was a palliative. It was a policy necessitated by history at a point in time, which, in my opinion, has outlived its usefulness and from which we need to wean ourselves.
That's very well put. And I wanted to ask you about the asterisk next to the name, and that's a good way to describe it. And as I was reading your book, and listeners, I'm sure some listeners will know that you taught at Harvard. After Northwestern and Michigan, you went to Harvard. You were the first tenured Black professor of economics there. You've just said that you benefited in some ways from affirmative action in your early rise in the university. But I did want to ask you about, if it feels a bit like we're taking one step forward and two steps back, because I think you're right that some of the Supreme Court judgment in relation to affirmative action and some of the discussion that it's given rise to is very positive. At the same time, of course, we've got DEI initiatives, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which seem to be reproducing some of the sins of affirmative action, or certainly the later forms of affirmative action, in a new way. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking that in some ways you're like the anti-Claudine Gay. She was the president of Harvard who has recently fallen as a consequence of comments that she made in a congressional discussion on anti-Semitism and campus culture. Even the warts and all nature of your book, the fact that you are this professor who is willing to lay his life on the line, whereas she is this apparently very pristine, perfect person, and even the plagiarism scandal is causing her an enormous amount of shame and she's trying to hide it and trying to move on from it. Even that element where you're willing to say, these are the million mistakes I made, whereas she has to perform this kind of perfection in order to try to maintain her position in polite society. I thought that was a very interesting contrast. But given her story and those recent events that we've seen and the rise of DEI more broadly, do you think it's possible that while we're willing to have a discussion about affirmative action, we might not be so willing to chip away at the idea that race should be a factor at all in the decisions we make in universities and elsewhere in public life?
I can see why you might say that, to which my answer would be one step at a time. First things first. I agree that the DEI sensibility in our institutions, not only in academic institutions, the anti-racism imperative, and we have to be welcoming, belonging. We have to make sure that people feel that they belong. We have to be sensitive to the environment that we are creating here for students of color, as they put it. That sensibility is much broader than affirmative action. And you can get rid of racial preferences and admission. And that sensibility of hyper-concern about identity and sending of a message to the students that this is the most important thing about them, and a distorting of the institution's functioning in order to accommodate the identitarian demands of these various constituencies within the institution, that's with us. Though I would say, you mentioned Claudine Gay and the controversies about anti-Semitism, how striking it is that in the aftermath of this controversy about how students, radicals on campuses are reacting to Israel's prosecution of its war in Gaza, the vulnerability of the DEI, when they got serious pushback from supporters of Israel or people who were offended by the campus protest or those who perceive anti-Semitism and the activism and sympathy for Palestinians and the students and so on, some of which sympathy for Palestinians dovetails with the diversity, equity, and inclusion establishment in the sense that the Palestinians are perceived as somehow non-Western or non-white or whatever, and the conflict with Israel is perceived somehow as an instantiation of a neo-colonialist, so on. This is all DEI think. And it's not faring very well in the larger political contestation. And some of the pushback coming from people, some of whom have influence because they are donors at universities or they have access to media influence and so on, suggests to me a vulnerability, a thinness to the DEI hegemony. So affirmative action is one dimension of this, but it's not the only thing that's going on. And as far as former president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, is concerned, I thought that the plagiarism charges were real and had substance, but they would not have gone at all very deeply if she had been, excuse me for saying this, a more substantial person. If she had had a more definitive record of outstanding intellectual contribution, the fact that she cut some corners or lifted a text here or there, bad as that is, might not have been fatal. But she was a product of DEI, not only in that she advocated for the various programs and initiatives that were diversity related in her position as an administrator and leader in Harvard University, but also because of the fact that she ended up a full professor at Harvard University with a handful of mediocre papers and without any deep intellectual contribution to point to be able to say, this is the book that I wrote that changed the field. This is the idea that I developed. This is the technique that I brought to the attention of my colleagues that now six graduate students are writing dissertations, et cetera. She didn't have that. So she was exposed as an empty suit, academically speaking, and the plagiarism stuff made it easy to do that, in my opinion.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable, and I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now, on with the show.
Well, the more pushback, the better. I think there's no question about that. I really agree there. Glenn, okay, just a couple of quick questions on contemporary politics before I let you go. I think one of the most interesting things about you is that you have found yourself in hot water with both the right and the left. I always think that's a pretty good position to be in. It proves that one is not slavishly devoting oneself to any particular tribe, but is saying what one thinks to be true and right at that particular moment. So I always take it as a positive sign if one is ticking off both sides. You got into trouble with the right because there was a time at which you thought they weren't actually taking some of the problems facing African-American communities sufficiently seriously. And of course, you got in trouble with the left because they always write off people like you as token black conservatives who are just playing a role for the right and probably don't even know what you're doing. You know, they have that incredibly paternalistic judgment of black conservatives. And you still get that now, of course, and there are others who get it as well. Where would you position yourself now on the political spectrum? Or is it even worth saying that these days? You know, how do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as left? Do you see yourself as right? And do you think there is too much tribalism on both of those sections of the political divide, as evidenced, I guess, by some of the experiences that you've had?
Too much tribalism, yes. I guess I'd locate myself center-right. I did have a falling out with my friends on the right in the 1990s. And it was, as you say, because I thought, even though I agreed with them that the liberal program of social reform, which we've criticized here in talking about affirmative action or talking about policing, or if we had been talking about social welfare policy, a similar criticism of the left could have been formulated. I agreed with my friends on the right that those were mistaken policies coming from the progressives. But I thought, notwithstanding that, the fact of subordination and inequality and disadvantage and marginalization and social isolation and so on of too many of our fellow Americans who descended from slaves was a first order problem for the society, one that we needed to continue to work to redress, even if we rejected the liberal programs to do so. And I began to suspect that in the early mid-1990s, that many of my compatriots on the right were not so troubled by the fact of black poverty, overrepresentation amongst the incarcerated, school failure, ill health, segregation in disadvantaged communities, victimization of violent criminal predation, and so forth. They were prepared, I thought, at that time, to shrug, lament, but say, let's move on. And I couldn't countenance that. And that initiated a period in which I moved away from my comfortable position amongst the neoconservative American intellectuals, which I had occupied through the 80s and into the early 90s, and inaugurated a period of me kind of having no real political home. I have in the book critically reviewed my journey there and acknowledge that while the motives I just got through describing to you were certainly at play, that there were other motives that also were at work in driving me leftward in the 1990s, having to do largely with my personal sense of wanting to be affirmed by co-racialists, wanting to, as it were, come home again. I was getting pressure all over the place. I describe in the book a scene where I go home to Chicago. I give a big lecture at the University of Illinois' Chicago campus. My uncle, Alfred, whom I loved, he's been dead for some years now, attends. He's the father of 22 altogether, and a dozen of his sons come along with him to this public event at the University of Illinois where I'm giving a lecture. And I give the lecture, and they hear it. And afterwards, there's a reception, and Alfred takes me aside at the reception, my beloved uncle, and he says, "We could only send one." He had listened to my talk, and he didn't like it. He didn't like the fact that I was flirting with conservatism, even then when I was already starting to move leftward, but not far enough and quickly enough for him. He says, "We could only send one off to Harvard and MIT and all of that. We sent you, and we don't see us in anything you do. Who are you? Don't you know that these people," he's talking about white people, he's talking about the establishment, "that we're in a struggle to the death with these people? We expect you to be much edgier, much more subversive, much more disquieting to the comfortable establishment than you have shown yourself to be. We're disappointed in you," he said. And that angered me, because I thought, I'm doing the best I can living my life. I'm not living your life. I'm living my life. I didn't betray the South Side of Chicago by becoming a man of the world as I have become over the last quarter century. And I'm speaking my mind here, I thought. And you should be listening rather than expecting me to parrot your political program. I thought that. On the other hand, I thought also, this is my beloved uncle. This is my family. These are my cousins. This is who I am and where I'm from. And I'm alienated from them. And I found that difficult to live with. So there were those kind of pressures, as well as more prosaic political calculation, that were at work for me as I moved left. I've come to think, in the fullness of time, I'll just say in conclusion, that that was a mistake, that I was pretty much on point in my relative conservatism of the 1980s and 90s, certainly with respect to these issues having to do with race and inequality. And I think the evidence for that position has been pretty compelling, especially in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter movement and the post-George Floyd political developments, which I think have been very destructive and going in exactly the wrong direction.
Yeah. Your book captures so well the, you know, the extraordinary pressures that someone can feel if they are from a working class background, but they find themselves in academia, or if they want to write about what they think is best for the African-American community or the working class community, but they feel the pressures of the left, who have a certain agenda, and the right, who has a certain agenda. So the pressures, I think, cannot be underestimated in terms of simply trying to work out what's true, what's right, what is the right thing to think, and what's the right thing to say. And I think your book and your story, the story of your life, captures that incredibly well in the memoir. All right, Glenn, it would be remiss of me not to ask you at least one question about Donald Trump. And there's a really fascinating bit where you write about the visceral pleasure you felt as you first heard Trump slinging out insults at, you know, turbo smug liberals on one hand, and cut off conservatives who don't understand ordinary people on the other hand, and that kind of visceral glee you felt when you saw him doing that. And I think a lot of people will relate to that, whether people are pro-Trump or anti-Trump. I think they will understand his interesting nature as a battering ram against both sides of the divide who had become too self-satisfied. You subsequently change your mind about Trump, or you had a rethink about Trump, and you became more concerned with some of the things he was doing and some of the things he was saying. I wonder where you stand now as you guys head for an election later this year. What's your take on the landscape of American politics, Trump versus Biden? Is it interesting in any way? Do you feel excited, or is it a bit dispiriting?
Well, it definitely has my attention. It's interesting, without any question. It's vitally important. There's going to be an election in November, and the candidates could not be standing in more different places. Trump was just convicted of 34 counts of a felony violation of the law in a New York City courtroom. We have a convicted felon now who stands on the brink of being reelected president of the United States. He's Trump, leading in many of the polls and is in a relatively strong position vis-a-vis Joseph Biden, who is a singularly uninspiring candidate. Yes, I must admit, I got up on the edge of my chair with a smile on my face during some of these press conferences and other encounters where Trump would be lambasting the smug, supercilious, arrogant, self-righteous liberal leadership and political voices and so on. I thought, in a way, he was speaking for a lot of people with whom I could identify. They weren't all white, but many of them were. They were not all poorly educated, but most of them were not postgraduate professionals making a living with their laptops. They were real American people, and he addressed them in ways that they found to be satisfying and inspiring. And I thought, this guy who comes from outside the establishment, although he doesn't really, does he? I mean, one of the things that he said that I found most compelling was that the system is rigged. I can tell you this because I've been in the system for, 25 or 30 years doing real estate deals in New York City. And I can tell you that the system is rigged. I've given to both of these parties campaign contributions, and I know what those contributions can buy in terms of access and influence. Trump lost the election in 2020, notwithstanding the fact that there were irregularities and there were issues that one could say it should have gone differently, too much mail-in balloting, too much changing the rules of the electoral management at the last minute, and so on, not enough ballot security. And you could raise questions. But at the end of the day, those questions are going to be raised in every electoral session. You have courts as the only medium for resolving those questions. He availed himself of the courts, and he got nowhere. He should have stepped down. Instead, he looked for a way to hold on to power. I thought that was unconscionable, and think that that was unconscionable. I think, in a way, that behavior could be disqualifying of somebody to hold that high office. So my problem with Trump is the way that he conducted himself in the aftermath of the 2020 election, notwithstanding the fact that he had every reason to go to court and to try to raise questions about it. He availed himself without success of that remedy. He should have stepped aside gracefully. He didn't do that. That's a problem.
Glenn, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brendan.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use. Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.